Jay Powell, venture capital, and a trip to a food court, in pretty much that order. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 14th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today, as we not infrequently do, with a number, an economic indicator, and then the why it matters backstory. The number of choice today is what's called the Producer Price Index, inflation at the wholesale level, which we learned this morning was up 7.3% in June from a year ago. A very high number by recent historical standards, but not, said Fed Chair Jay Powell today, in and of itself something he is going to worry about. Powell, as we told you yesterday, was the guest of honor at a House Financial Services Committee hearing today. 3 hours of lawmaker questions and Powell answers, including this one. To the question of when are we going to know inflation is transitory, like you, Mr. Powell, keep on promising.
Before we get fully back to normal, I think we'll know generally whether this framework for understanding it is the right one.
Yeah, that was kind of a vague start, but he did get more specific.
We would want to begin to see more things like what happened with lumber. We'd want to begin to see more of these prices flatten out and then perhaps come down, hopefully, as lumber did.
Told you about lumber yesterday, you remember that? But if it doesn't.
Ultimately, though, price stability is half of our mandate. And if we see inflation moving up in a way that's really troubling and that risks a period of troublingly high inflation, then we'll use our tools to bring inflation back down to 2%.
It is going to be lather, rinse, repeat for the Fed chair tomorrow. Same deal before the Senate Banking Committee. Apologies for the terrible audio, by the way. It was one of those virtual hearings yet again. In straight-up corporate news today, commercial aviation. Delta Airlines reported quarterly profits of more than $650 million this morning. That breaks a five-quarter streak of losses. The turnaround is thanks to the billions in federal relief that airlines got and the return of leisure travel to 2019 levels. Surprising and overwhelming is what Delta said about leisure travelers. And the company also said that while it is not having trouble staffing its flights, Delta's contractors have struggled to hire people to do things like prepare the food and gas up the planes. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent his day on the slice of the flying experience that is not actually being run by the airline you happen to be flying.
So when you fly, especially to or from a city that's not a hub for a major airline, most of the folks that you encounter won't actually be employed by the airline that sold you the ticket. That's according to industry analyst Robert W. Mann.
That would include everything from the greeter that meets you at the curb, you know, with a wheelchair, to ticket agents, to baggage handlers, and other services.
He says in the U.S., airlines have been peeling off parts of their operations since the industry was deregulated in the late 1970s.
And some of these companies were actually set up by the carriers themselves.
He says the idea there was for airlines to use non-union workers at lower wages. And Michael Boyd, an airline industry consultant, says from a cost perspective, outsourcing still makes a lot of sense for airlines.
The downside to that is some of those companies, they don't pay very well. They don't have benefits. We work with a couple of them that pay $10 an hour, no benefits, work the flight and go home. Do you think that employee really gives a rip whether you fly that airline again? I don't think so.
He says third-party contracts come up for renewal about every 3 years or so. And Andrew Medland, a transportation analyst at Oliver Wyman, says that gives airlines the chance to assess whether or not to bring certain elements of the flying experience back under their own corporate umbrellas.
I think with a number of airlines, it's a constant consideration as they focus on both the cost to deliver the operation as well as their ability to have control over and to better manage to objectives what it is they're trying to do.
He says the amount an airline outsources is cyclical. Airlines are more likely to look for cost savings when revenue is down because folks aren't flying. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Wednesday, not a whole lot of anything. Really, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. So things have been economically weird the last 18 months or so. Worse at the beginning than now, yes, but weird all the same. Through it all, there have been some constants, and we've covered those, but this one caught our eye this morning. New data out from the National Venture Capital Association that kind of gives you pause. For the first half of 2021, venture capitalists have invested $150 billion in startups, that is, seed stage to late stage companies. That's nearly as much as was invested in all of 2020, which was in itself a record-breaking year, pandemic or no. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on there.
The last 2 years have been blockbuster for venture capital deals and dollars, not in spite of COVID, but kind of because of it, says Jeff Farah at the National Venture Capital Association. There have been all the new work-from-home technologies and vaccines we needed.
Companies like Moderna and Zoom really did so much to be able to propel us through a lot of the problems that we had.
And investors have had plenty of cash to risk in fields like
cybersecurity, climate technology, in healthcare, around testing, PPE.
But for the smallest startups that entrepreneurs found one or two at a time and bootstrap, things have not been so rosy. Philip Gaskin at the Kauffman Foundation says startup rates were flat or declining in the boom years before the pandemic. Then in the midst of all the job loss and small businesses closing,
the number of business starts, registered business starts, was the highest in some 25 years. Now, most of those starts were out of necessity rather than by choice.
And he says they'll face big obstacles.
83% of entrepreneurs do not receive venture capital or traditional loan. And the overwhelming majority of new business owners use their own or family wealth to get started.
And moving up the pipeline to fundamental scientific R&D, Northwestern University business professor Ben Jones says there's also trouble.
Public investment in research and development from the United States is at its lowest level in the last 70 years.
And he warns if we don't boost public research funding at university and government labs, future advances in fields like quantum computing, nanotechnology, and AI will suffer. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Two quick things before we go on. Number one, podcasts. If you miss us on the air, try us there. Number two, newsletters. We do those too. Our Make Me Smart newsletter, a companion to the podcast that Molly Wood and I do this week, talking child tax credits. Marketplace.org/newsletters to subscribe. Even before the pandemic, there were a lot of downtowns and a lot of American cities that just weren't keeping up. They were getting left behind economically as demographics and job patterns and real estate prices all changed. So the people who've taken it as their mission to revitalize those downtowns kind of have to get creative, both in the kinds of businesses they open and the form, literally the physical form, that those businesses take. So the other day, we took a quick drive out to Montebello, California. It's about 8 or 10 miles east of downtown L.A. to a soon-to-be-opened outdoor food court, I guess you'd call it.
So welcome to Boulevard Market. Thanks for coming down.
Well, yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me. Why don't you set the scene for us? Tell us who you are and where we are.
Yeah, so my name is Barney Santos. I'm one of the founders of Boulevard Market. We're in the city of Montebello right now. This is specifically the downtown area of Montebello.
This looks like a place more people drive through than actually stop and do that shopping and consuming thing that this business counts on.
Yeah, so I think you would be pretty accurate in your observation.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, this early, right? It's kind of like...
Well, that's a fair point. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. That's a fair point. But you know.
Yeah, but it is definitely one of those like places where it isn't really established yet in the retail sense or like a density perspective, right? So like Old Town Pasadena or like downtown Los Angeles or anything like that. So... you see a lot of like the storefronts here are really kind of traditional legacy businesses, right?
And very so, much so. You got a bridal shop down there. You got realty and pet supplies. You got a bargain shop that's seen better days across the street. I mean, right. there's not a lot of activity.
Yeah, I would say there's definitely not a lot of modern or economic activity that you right. would sort of normally right. associate with a downtown.
Well, so look. Then I have to ask you why you chose this spot. The corner is 6th and Whittier. I mean, right? What are we doing here?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And I think a lot of our investors and a lot of our lenders and, you know, people that we kind of work with asked us that very same question, to be honest with you.
And?
Well,
they obviously bought in, right? Because here we are standing here. So what was the pitch? What'd you tell them?
To be honest with you, what we sold when we sold this idea was not currently what's here, but the potential of what's here, of what could be here. What we know for sure is that communities like this, like the city of Montebello, are experiencing sort of like economic downturns because they're seeing a disconnect between the upwardly mobile millennial class that is getting more educated, getting better jobs, getting better pay. And ultimately what they're doing is they're leaving these cities, right? And sort of because they're moving to West LA or downtown Los Angeles, more economically advanced communities. And so this leaves a gap in these markets that a lot of these sort of traditional businesses aren't really evolving to sort of meet.
They're being left behind, these businesses.
A little bit, yeah. And so, you're talking about immigrant businesses like that own a lot of these mainstream companies. Yeah. And so they don't know what it means to evolve technology-wise. A lot of these places accept cash only, right? And so, like, that's a huge thing that, millennials, I haven't carried cash in my wallet for a long time, right?
Yeah.
That's what I was selling, which was the idea was like, look, we're going to create a place that can act as an anchor in a very untraditional way, so that we can keep that raw talent, so that we can attract millennials and say, look, this place is worth staying at,
All right, so hold that thought about creating an anchor, and let's walk around the corner away from Whittier Boulevard and the Sound. You're from around here. I mean, South LA, Southeast LA. You've been here your whole life.
When I came here to Montebello, I live here now. Essentially, there was a sort of stark reality from what, like, downtown Los Angeles was to what this place was.
So here we are in a courtyard, and it's an old brick building on one side that used to be a what? What does that say?
It used to be a carpet.
A carpet shop? Building.
Yeah, so Right Loom Carpet.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, so that building's actually 100 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, so we actually wanted to keep the integrity of that building. Yeah.
So you got a cool old building on one side, and then a courtyard formed by, these are shipping containers.
Yeah.
This will be a place where people can come and sample various kitchens and foods and just sit here in the courtyard.
What we know about food is that it brings people together. And so if you go to Europe, you go to Mexico City, you see these concepts have existed there for over 100 years. They're called plazas, or they're called areas.
Piazzas, squares, right,
exactly,
right,
squares. Yeah. And so we're essentially taking that same idea and saying, okay, if it works in those areas, it should work here, right? And there's a tight-knit community here that is hungry for this type of stuff.
How do you know?
I've talked to them. I mean, I spent over a year doing just intense primary research.
Okay, so why? You spent years of your life doing this.
Yeah.
And look, you're a young guy, and I'm sure there's a zillion other things you could do.
That's right. it's taken me probably about 5 to 6 years to get to this place. Our life savings are into this, to be honest with you. It's been my wife and I from day one, just kind of building this thing together. I think what really matters to me is investing in our communities. Like, I'm Latino. I live in these communities, and I've seen other places. And I think it's time for our communities to have things like this in our community. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's important for us.
All right. So, like I said, as we were coming around the corner, I said, hold that thought on being an anchor for development around here, right? Mm-hmm. What happens when places like this gentrify is that usually the first thing is some kind of anchor place. It's a coffee shop. Oh, look, there's a coffee shop. Or it's, I did an interview in Inglewood, and there's a microbrewery going in, and oh, look, there's a brewery, right? And gentrification does a lot of things for a lot of people, but for the people who are there who are conceivably getting displaced, it's maybe not so great. You worry about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that we thought about from the beginning. Like, since the moment we started this business, it was something that was top of mind for us, always. The worst thing we could become is brown gentrifiers, right?
Right.
Like, we don't want that at all. So we've done a lot of work outside of just building this space to kind of like ensure that we can help somewhat, offset those things. So obviously we're sourcing a lot of the businesses locally, like to make sure that it's local investment, local entrepreneurs opening up here. It's give and take. Like a part of me is very conscious about that, and I worry about that a lot. But also part of me knows that in these communities, you need an investment from someone to kind of help ignite economic development. I would rather it be from someone from the community who can do it responsibly with intention and trying to like help as much as they can versus someone who just wants to come in and do whatever they need to do and just make money and get out. Right.
So you open August is your actual opening?
Yeah, we're shooting for an August weekend.
So if we come back next August, what's in your mind's eye right here?
we're bursting at the seams. Smiles on people's faces. All of the businesses here are crushing it. Maybe there's a live band, right? I'm pretty sure there'll be a live band. You can have a great time here where you feel comfortable, where you'll feel, where you're, more importantly, you feel seen. In addition to that, it has a ripple effect to the downtown. More shops coming in. Other creatives will start taking up space, and they'll feel empowered to do their thing also.
Barney, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, guys. Pleasure meeting you.
Coming up,
getting a salary that I can live off of.
Which kind of depends on where you live, too. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 44 points today, about a 10%, 34,933 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 32 points, about 0.2%, 14,644. S&P 500 up 5 at 10%, 43.74. The pay gap between executives and other workers at big U.S. companies has been growing, as we know, since the 2008 recession last year. There's no exception. That's according to the AFL-CIO's recent Executive Pay Watch report. It says executives received, on average, $15.5 million in total compensation. The average production and non-supervisory worker, $43,512. Bond prices were up today. That means the yield goes the other way. Inflation, schminflation, 10-year at 1.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Olympics, which start in just a bit more than a week, are going to be interesting. Tokyo is in a state of emergency. There aren't going to be any fans in the stands, local or overseas visitors. Just, it's going to be weird. That said, the Games are a multi-billion dollar investment and a multi-billion dollar business opportunity, driven in very large part by advertising and sponsorships. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked at whether losing some of the spirit of the Games might mean a loss for companies, too.
Despite the fact that it's very much the year 2021, this Summer Olympics is still branded as Tokyo 2020. One big reason? Money. Matthew Katz is a professor of sport management at UMass Amherst.
Something that seems as simple as changing every visual from 2020 to 2021 and every voiceover, right, and every piece of merchandise, that would be an enormous, enormous undertaking.
T-shirts and commemorative medallions and crowd favorites like noisemakers, binoculars, and hot weather necessities.
The cooling off fan feels like a tough piece of merchandise to sell if you're not there in person.
A lot of this stuff will probably go to waste. So will some of the money sponsors spent on being part of the experience. This Olympics official beer, Asahi, had counted on serving drinks to an international audience. Martin Conway, a professor at Georgetown University who did marketing for Major League Baseball teams, puts it pretty bluntly.
Well, for this particular Olympics, you've made a mistake.
Besides slapping the Olympic logo on a beer can, there's not much sponsors can do. And the biggest marketing money is in TV ads. Kantar Media, which measures audiences and advertising, estimates that the Games will bring in $2.2 billion in ad revenue. But the energy ads depend on won't be the same. Imagine Kerry Strug's gymnastics vault comeback, or Usain Bolt officially becoming the fastest man alive without the roar of a crowd.
And here comes Usain Bolt! Usain Bolt storming through! He takes makes it again. Blake. As consumers are engaged with the content, it amplifies engagement with the advertising that surrounds the event.
Gregory Aston is Kantar's director of research. He says there are still benefits to buying time during the biggest live event in the world, and brands are prepared. They've already used crowdless baseball and basketball games as test cases. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
According to the National Interagency Fire Center, the people who keep track of these kinds of things, there are almost 70 large wildfires and wildfire complexes burning in the United States right now, all but a few of them out here in the West. And among the firefighters on the front lines are men and women who jump out of planes or hike deep into the forests toward the fires. Smoke jumpers, hotshots. You've heard of them, I'm sure. They work for the federal government. The national forests are their responsibility, but they are paid a lot less than their counterparts at state and local fire agencies. Federal firefighters start at just $15 an hour, and that is after President Biden just gave them a $2 an hour raise. Now, we know in this economy, with rising wages and an at least short-term labor shortage, workers can do better than that. And as it happens, federal firefighters are quitting in droves. Marketplace's Nova Sappho did some reporting on plans to keep those firefighters on the job.
Jonathan Golden wanted to be a hotshot ever since he was 18 years old, when he first saw the elite group combat a wildfire in Montana. That was 21 years ago.
They were well-organized, disciplined, in shape, put together, and I knew that that was probably the organization to be a part of if I could.
By his mid-20s, Golden was a hotshot himself, working for the U.S. Forest Service. But he struggled to live on a wage of less than $12 an hour.
For single me, it was barely enough. I mean, you know, you're like trying to get like 1,000 hours of overtime in a season to have enough to cover your basic day-to-day needs.
Golden, like many federal firefighters, was also a seasonal employee. He wasn't paid for many months out of the year. Still, he says he loved his work, and like many of his colleagues, took pride in helping preserve national forests. But 11 years in, the low pay and excessive overtime took their toll.
I think I just came home from an assignment, and I just kind of had it, and I left to go to grad school and try to do something completely different.
Golden now runs his own consulting firm. The federal government is losing a lot of firefighters like him, mid-career with lots of training. These firefighters are leaving the profession or joining local and state agencies that pay more, sometimes twice as much. There are also private companies luring away federal firefighters. Aaron Humphrey went to work for one of them, a California power utility. He says his earnings went up by more than 60%.
Me transitioning to this job, getting a salary that I can live off of and not have to stress on overtime and being gone all the time, it's a huge, huge relief to my family and my life.
I've been seeing a decline in the morale for the last few years.
That's Reva Duncan. She used to manage firefighter staffing at a national forest in Oregon. She retired in December. And by her last fire season, she says, she didn't have a full staff of firefighters on duty.
The demands with these longer fire seasons, these larger catastrophic fires, is taking its toll on folks, and certainly the low pay. And just feeling like, you know, they're not valued is pretty difficult on folks.
Federal officials have acknowledged that they're having challenges staffing enough firefighters during wildfire seasons, and that wages have not kept up. Chuck Sheely of the National Smoke Jumper Association says low wages and longer wildfire seasons are also making it hard to attract young people into entry-level positions.
As a nation, we've been able to get by with the firefighters we had, but now we're reaching a point where the demand for firefighters is not meeting what we get for recruits.
Grassroots Wildland Firefighters, which is an advocacy group, estimates the federal firefighting force is down by about 25%. And Washington is paying attention. Last month, in a meeting with Western governors to discuss wildfire response, President Biden said he's immediately raising federal firefighters' starting pay from $13 to $15 an hour.
But a one-time boost is not enough. These courageous women and men take an incredible risk of running toward the fire, and they deserve to be paid and paid good wages. You know that old expression? God made man, then he made a few firefighters? Well, it's true.
Congress may also act through the bipartisan infrastructure bill moving through the Senate. Lawmakers have added a provision to raise entry-level base pay for federal firefighters by $20,000 a year. If passed, that would amount to a 70% pay raise. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today to be filed under Y from Kraft Heinz and the Brooklyn-based ice cream maker Van Leeuwen. An announcement, a limited edition macaroni and cheese flavored ice cream. From the press release, a cool, creamy scoop of ice cream that brings the comforting, nostalgic feeling from a warm bowl of Kraft macaroni and cheese. I like ice cream. I like mac and cheese. Hard, hard pass. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context, one that I missed yesterday, but about which, Fitch, the credit rating people, issued a report yesterday on the quality of U.S. debt. We are still AAA, the gold standard, but Fitch says the outlook for our rating is negative because, and this is a quote, because of a deterioration of governance, as in our politics is hurting us economically. Media production around here is Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Leanna Squalachi, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.